At GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock. I'm Doug Davidson, and our guest today is founder, advisor, investor, Keith Stevens. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be here, buddy. Thanks for asking me to join you.
I guess I don't know if it's scoped, looked at, or creeped on your LinkedIn. Looked at your titles in LinkedIn, and that's where I got the founder, advisor, and investor. But I know enough about you that I can add community contributor to it. I can add GBQ client to it. I can add GBQ service provider because your firm does some work for my team. But I know those apply, and I'm sure there's a lot of missing titles as well. I think we've got a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
So let's start with PSI. I know PSI is a satisfied client. In fact, I know Monica and Monty over there. I've known them for quite a long time before I met you. But I understand right. from some of the reading I did that in 1992, PSI was Keith. And so there's quite a gap from just Keith to multi-million dollar business providing IT services and some staffing services to companies in Columbus and beyond. Can you fill the gap in? How did that climb happen from 92 to now?
Yeah, sure. So I was working as a copier technician, really wanted to sell copiers, but did not have a degree. Funny story, right? So then in 1992, temporary staffing agencies were starting to bubble up. And along with that, there was this need in centrally located communities near Eastside, South Linden, Parsons, et cetera, for work opportunities. At the same time, 270 was starting to be developed as a logistics supply kind of hub. I didn't have much money, but borrowed $500, found a space that I could afford. We started doing what's called labor on demand. Initially, I found opportunities with employers, but I couldn't get people to work on their own. So we bought in vans. And at one point, we had 15 passenger vans and 450 passenger buses. So what started as just an idea and really with the mission of finding work opportunities for these underrepresented communities. In that time, they were called the hardcore unemployable, Doug, if you could believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And that was what you saw in the media and people bought into it. But those people in those neighborhoods, 95, 98% were hardworking. They just wanted what every other family wanted for their children and for themselves. So it was a good time for us to start the business. We grew rapidly. We went from zero to $8 million in the first 8 years. Along came 2001, 9/11, and then a recession that followed. And there was an opportunity to pivot. And part of that was intentional, and part of it was client demand. And as you know, oftentimes client demand will take you down the path you weren't necessarily planning to go. So we got into professional staffing. 2008, another inflection point with the Great Recession. And that's when we pivoted 100% into technology. And so it's been interesting where we started to where we are now. And people think about the story. And those who've known and watched it up close and personal just find it pretty remarkable that we've been able to pivot a couple different times. And now we're doing really great work. We're growing quickly. And our delivery is spot on. And so it's been an interesting ride. It's been an interesting 28 years. I hate to admit that it dates myself.
That is long. That is, yeah.
Yes.
But it's not an age. That's not an age long. A lot of businesses, the first 3 to 5 years are touchy and, so many firms start. And so a pivot really is a restart, right? And so to start and then restart and continuously change to the market over 28 years is pretty remarkable.
Well, and I think, we talk about innovation and pivoting. I think they go hand in hand. And for me, innovation oftentimes happens as a result of some unexpected blow to the head, right? So,
right.
And it's in the fetal position that I have my best. That's what I come up with my best, right? And I actually have a Tempur-Pedic bed. And I used to joke with people that memory foam, the imprint in my bed on my side of the bed was me in the fetal position. And I say that proudly because I think a lot of people, they struggle when adversity hits and there's a pity party, we all do, but you can't let the pity party go on. You actually have to get up and face the problems. And so for me, that's when we pivot out of, in some cases, being forced. Now, the beauty of where we are now, we can be a little more intentional. I do own 49% of a San Francisco-based software engineering firm. That wasn't born out of any issue other than opportunity. And then one of the other businesses that was a spinoff 10 years ago on PSI, it's really around process improvement, employer of record, and that's doing quite well. So again, some of what we went through, there were times when we were like a wounded wildebeest on the side of the road waiting for a lion to come by and eat us down to our carcass. But fortunately, and I think there's some luck, but the willingness to get up and lean in, I think, has served us well.
Well, it's the not panicking, you know, the backpack. And it's like, if you get lost, don't panic. We joke, don't panic, eat lunch. And I've been on backpacking trips where you had three or four lunches, but you think your way through, whether it's in the fetal position or sitting on a log eating lunch, and you can overcome adversity. You get let that emotion get a hold of you. It doesn't work out well. So we've had some pivots given market conditions. Obviously, we all had an opportunity to join the pity party here over the last year or so. How did the pivot work this time? Because it was, I think, less about what you do, but how you work.
Well, I think so. I'll go back to 2008 and some of the lessons learned, the muscles that we built around responding to situations, for the most part, out of our control. What it did for us, and I think what the pandemic's done for a lot of other companies, it exposed our business model, the weaknesses in it, the weaknesses in our infrastructure, et cetera, the weaknesses in just our pricing, just across the board. And then we had a conversation with our bank where our bank wanted not to work with us any longer, which threw me off, but it was the best lesson I ever got, right? But out of that, we now had a playbook, if you will, for anything that might come down the pike going forward. And while the pandemic was different, when we initially heard about it and saw some of the impact, we had a plan A, B, C already. We had contingency plans. We were ready to go. We had communication steeped up with our clients. We had already gone to a remote work scenario. So the Zoom Teams, we were already using that before the pandemic hit. So that lift for us wasn't that difficult. The other thing I think is the foundation of the business is just our client relationships, and they held true. Our revenue actually increased by 10% over 2019. Now, we had predicted 25%, but a lot of companies didn't even equal 2019. And so the impact for us was nominal. And as a matter of fact, it really demonstrated for us the resiliency of our people and of our company and our client relationships.
Well, I can speak to Monty and Monica. We've worked with them, and we actually have 10 people on the IT services team here, and two of them have been found by your team and placed from PSI. They're both rock stars. One's in cybersecurity and managing that part of our business, and the other one is an investment we made into data analytics last year as we see firms trying to find more about their business story in the data. And we were able to come to PSI. And there are two things about Monica and Imani, both fun people to be with, but they also work hard and they produced in terms of adding to our staff. But, the last time I got to socialize with them, which was actually my official first business meeting with a drink and appetizers when we started to work back, they talked quite a bit about the system. And I've read in some of your profiles online about the business system. And you referred just a minute ago to a playbook. I was an entrepreneur. We all have our own system, but it sounds like the system that you've adopted has been pretty powerful in a part of that growth story.
Without a doubt. And Doug, what happened? I mean, we were kind of all over the place, and I'm sure you've been in business, you've had your business. You may have invested in strategic plans from a third-party consultant, and you go through the whiteboard sessions and sticky notes, et cetera, and then you get your strategy, right? And then it sits on the shelf and it gathers dust. It's not implemented. What really changed the game for us? A couple things. So first of all, let me just say, Monica's been with me, I forget how long. And I met her as a result of being on a nonprofit board and just watching how she approached the board, how she rolled her sleeves up, just how professionally mature she was, outgoing relationship monster, right? And you know that yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then Monty came along having worked in corporate IT staffing at Modus. Modus was acquired by Adecco. And they downsized his role. And it was just by chance that we'd known each other. He reached out to me. We closed Monty. And they've taken this thing to a whole nother level. But the thing that really changed the game and allows me to not work in a business or any of the businesses and actually work on them is the Entrepreneur Operating System. I don't know if you've heard of EOS. There's a book called Traction. There's a whole program around organizational structure, developing leadership, succession planning, just how to run your business and really get the most out of it. So something as simple as having level 10, they call meetings on a weekly basis where the agenda doesn't change. There's to-dos, there's quarterly expectations, et cetera, and people have to report in on that. And that just gave us this cadence of getting things done and accomplished. The other thing it actually helped us with as well the conversations could be very frank and open. In that room, there was no big I's and little U's, right? Anybody could say whatever they want to. And so there was discourse, there was conflict, et cetera. But we got to the other side of that. And as a result, tremendous trust was built. And I think probably the biggest piece was landing on our core values and living and dying by those core values, right? We're driven to serve, solve, deliver. We align those with the people we hire. When we look at GBQ to do business with you, we're looking through the lens of our core values. Do they align with yours? And we know they do. I mean, I know your leadership, et cetera. So it's a given there. But I think that's been what's been the biggest game changer for us. And now I don't have to be involved in the day-to-day. Monty and Monica are growing that thing. It's like getting ready to go on rocket fuel with the economy coming back. So, yeah, I'm very fortunate. Very fortunate.
I had not heard of EOS prior to doing my creeping of your history on the internet, but spent some time on their website. We'll make sure we put the link out. I know that I ran a business for 15 years before GBQ acquired it, and we had our own systems, and that looked pretty powerful because it was in a lot of ways very simple. So somebody that's starting up or somebody that's, you know, in the first third of their 28-year climb that doesn't have a system, I think that's a real valuable thing for them to look at and would be a great coaching point. So we'll make sure we point to that as part of the webpage that promotes this podcast.
Very cool. And I'm surprised. I was surprised to learn, as you know, I just stepped down as chair of the chamber. Darcy's actually your managing director now, is the chair. I'm surprised to learn how many organizations, smaller firms, have implemented EOS. And what I can say, I wish we'd have found it 20 years ago. If we'd found it 20 years ago, you and I might not be having this conversation. I'd be somewhere in Europe, although we could do it over Zoom, right?
Well, yeah, we'd be having a conversation, but I wouldn't see glass behind you. It would be maybe beach and palm fronds and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's getting a lot of notoriety. People are using it and actually benefiting quite significantly from EOS.
So, and we have talked about this before, I a lot of times get tagged as the tech guy here because I run the IT services practice and you have a technology business. But I think you're very clear. You're not the Uber geek that pounds on the keyboard and plays with the bits and the bytes, but you're a technology person because you've got a technology firm and you're a people person. And the world has been changed both technologically and from a people perspective. So I want to cover both, but I want to start with tech. What is, as your business starts to move forward now that things come back, you know, what did you see over the last 12, 15 months in a technical space? And what are you seeing moving forward in terms of, at a business level, speaking to business owners, what should they be looking at from a technological perspective, either to continue to innovate or to, you know, build some resiliency so if something bad happens again, they're in a better situation?
Yeah, I think you just touched on it. A lot of their business models, specifically their tech, was exposed. The lack of, or the fact that what they hadn't done a really good job of getting people trained up on it. So it just had, there was a lot of impact. Akava is the San Francisco-based software engineering studio. And our specialty is really building and shipping product, cloud transformation, DevSecOps. There's another one in there. But what we saw, because I got into that business with my partner because I wanted to introduce the emerging trends in the Midwest, right? And we're remote first. Well, pre-COVID, I was having a tough time and our sales guys were having a time to convince Midwest-based firms that remote will work for them. COVID-19 changed all that. That business had 600% growth last year. Unbelievable. And so we went from people not really buying into it in the Midwest and really depending on the startups, the soil seed, Series A, B, C companies that we support on the West Coast to getting quite a bit of adoption here in the Midwest. So that's the first thing. I think the other thing that I think I learned, so this is tech related, but maybe not so much, Doug, is that innovation and pivoting doesn't always need to rely on tech. Change can happen. It could be workflow. It could be the way you're engaging your clients, et cetera. Tech could enable it, but it's not necessarily in the forefront necessarily. But what we're seeing now is finding really good candidates is going to get tough. Companies are investing now in hiring people full time and relying a little less than they did on contract staff or project-based staff. We see that happening, but now it's a fight for who can attract and retain those consultants. If you've got people, you win. And we've gone through this in a couple of iterations in our life cycle. Even when we were doing light industrial staffing back in the day or office staffing in the day. When the unemployment rate goes down or when there's a shortage, if you've got people, you can. And for us, it's if we can't find them in the marketplace, then we've got to take them from somewhere. And I think Monty, based from an integrity perspective, we don't go to our clients and pull people out for another client, but we will go after other, unfortunately, from, you know, it's competition. And I think we've done a really good job there. I think we institute a contractor care program that has really set us apart with our contractor pop, with our consultant population. So I think the demand is going to increase pretty significantly. The challenge is going to be, can we find enough people?
Yeah.
So for the staffing side, that's one challenge. But for our consulting side, we'll now take those projects on, and companies are now more willing to give us the project. We'll take it and manage it ourselves, so they don't have to worry about staffing up, right? They can just get, we'll do a statement of work, we'll take it over. In a lot of cases, we'll do fixed fees, fixed scope, which seems to be attractive as well.
Well, it is, because that scope creep, it's never quite done. And if you can manage to a fixed scope, everybody wins. There's no uncertainty on the part of what the client's getting or paying for, and there's no uncertainty and less risk for you. You've got to be talented in managing it, and I assume you are.
We want to share risk, but with that, there's from the very onset, we're going to push, and the project now becomes our client, not necessarily you who are paying us. So if you get in the way or your team is holding us up, there's going to potentially be some contentious conversations. But what we found, even with that friction, we deliver, and at the end of that delivery, we get accolades that it was the best process they've ever gone through. So it's just, you know, every company has their dysfunction. They have intent, and mm-hmm. their intentions are good. But when you bring on a project, if it's not staffed up and if you're not committed to it, then it can die an uncertain death. And that's something that we just try to prevent as much as possible.
Well, and I started this with, you're a technology guy and a people guy. And it's funny because you jumped from technology to people. And back in the, 1992, when you were trying to employ people that, what was the permanently unemployable? You used the term, I should have written
hardcore.
Down. Hardcore unemployable.
What a moniker to put on a whole neighborhood, right?
I hear that in different ways now. And I know that for some of those people, they want a job, but they can't get to the job. There are obstacles and limitations. Some of us did really well in this market. And there are others that have been left behind. And then, as you alluded to, the competition for talent in the IT space is intense. But there are segments of the population that haven't been exposed to IT careers. They haven't been exposed to accounting careers either. And, we look at, I'm an information security professional. I do other things from a consulting perspective, but that's been the core is cybersecurity and privacy and security compliance work. And there are a lot of positions open, but not a lot of talent to feed them. And if you look at it as a math problem, we have to find people of color and women that have the skills and the aptitude and the attitude to come in and work in those spaces. We've talked before. I know you see some of that as well. And it's not just reaching out to neighborhoods that might be labeled, but it's really exposing individuals to careers that would be more resilient in a time like last year. If you were in professional services, it was a good year for most professional services. If you were in a personal services industry, restaurants, really feel horrible for the restaurants. There's others that it was just a tough way to go. And many of those people that are in those industries have the ability to work in our technology industry. You've seen a lot of that limitation, and how do we lift those people up?
Well, I see the limitation, but I also see quite a bit of effort in trying to change that calculus, right? True story. So AEP is one of our larger clients. And on the PSI side, I don't know, on any given day, I won't see a number. I don't want to tip off our competition in case they hear this, but we've got a significant number of resources in there on the IT staff side, right? They've got a new CIO, and I've got really good relationships all the way up to the top, but I met the new CIO, Therese Rish. She's a female. And we were talking to her about some of the niche skill sets she was missing and some of the transformation AEP's going through, cloud, et cetera. So I'm feeling really cool, Doug. I've got this picture of our engineering team on the Akava side from the West Coast, right? I'm gonna blow her away with this image and what we do and some referenceable work. And I sent it to her and didn't notice and got called out. Nothing but men. Now there's diversity, but there's 23 engineers, architects, et cetera, and no women. And I expected her, once she got my information, to call me quickly. Let's talk about some work. Instead, she said, where's the women? And I couldn't answer that question. Now, we have relationships with Girls That Code on the West Coast, but the larger organizations, they've got relationships in there. They've created a pipeline that won't allow a smaller player to kind of get in.
Yeah.
What we're doing here in Columbus, we're part of NCUS, the National Center for Urban Solutions, and they've set up a tech piece called ITAP. There's a commercial running now on Channel 4. And it's really about, it's connecting Chase and Apprenti and Cover My Meds, and some of these organizations are coming together to work on this problem. And NCUS has been an urban player. They actually sponsor the African American Male Wellness Walk. They've been playing in this space for a long time, both here around the state and a couple of other states around the country. And the goal is, how do we start to evolve some of their clients who most likely are at or below the poverty line from a family perspective, underrepresented people of color, and this is starting to germinate. And I think there's a lot of other opportunities out there. PSI, we've done a boot camp, if you will, with Job and Family Services at the state with Tech Elevator. And we've got some coders, some developers in there that came in with limited exposure. They're working there now and learning and growing. And I think it's just going to take more of that. But you're absolutely right. And here's the thing I love about this scenario. And I got to tell you, before pandemic, what I loved about the low unemployment rate was that in order to be profitable, companies had to think differently about how they attracted people and who they were okay bringing into their facilities, right? It really created an opportunity. I chair the Alvis board. Alvis is a second chance organization, really working with justice involved people, et cetera. They were getting calls every day for people. I hope it gets back to that point, but more specifically around tech, I think there's upskilling that's going on inside of organizations. I know Amazon has a program in place that if you're pushing boxes around the warehouse, they'll pay for vocational training in a tech space and welcome you to leave. I mean, they'll happily say, see you, be successful, et cetera. So I think there's some effort happening. I think there's going to be more dollars thrown at it. And it'll be interesting to see how it all turns out. I think the other thing too, and then I'll shut up, and that's, you've got corporations creating their own schools, they're pulling people in out of high school and training them up. We've got some offshore resources. McKinsey is hiring 25,000 engineers, entry-level engineers in India. They see something out in the future that they're prepping for. So my answer to you is there's things going on that hopefully change that narrative, but I think time will tell. But we're involved with NCUS. We're excited about it and excited to get back to the CIO of AEP and show her what we've done, right? Whether we ever do any business with her on the software engineering side or not, she called us out and it was a good call out. It was a great call out.
So your instinct, the one thing I've heard, your instinct is the client demand, meet the client. And you said that a couple times, but your story is spot on. She said, where are the women? And you went out and trying to respond to that client demand. That's really a key part of being an entrepreneur.
Well, it shut down my sales too. My whole idea, and for me, it's not like the traditional selling. I'm trying to sell in a very strategic way, but I can't go back to her until I put some effort in, because she called me out on something that whether we ever do business with AEP or not, based on what we do, we can provide some internships through our innovation lab in Boatley in California. I mean, some things we can do that we're not doing. So it was just a great call out, a great wake-up call for me specifically.
I think people that have never owned their own business, a lot of times people would say to me when I was running my firm before I joined here at GBQ, was it must be great not to have any bosses. And that's not true. You've got a bunch of bosses and every single client is a boss. That's cool that you're listening and you're hearing and responding to that.
Well, I think another mantra for us that we live by is the client has the luxury of being unreasonable. In her case, she wasn't being that way, but they have that luxury. So don't take it personally, guys. Let's figure out how to manage to that, right?
Well, at 56, I've been in consulting for 30 years. 30 years ago, I took things personally and got emotional about them. And now you can have fun and respond to unreasonable demands. And one of the partners here will occasionally say, well, nobody's died. And obviously in tech, sometimes really bad things can happen, but most of the time, as long as you deal with people as individuals, it can be a real fun thing to do, is to respond to those unreasonable demands and adjust and pivot and meet your client's needs. So that's a cool story. You'd shared that before with me, and I'm glad you shared it today. So when I go out on the internet, I look at your LinkedIn, and LinkedIn says we are coworkers. My first full-time job out of college was a staff member in the economic development department at the Chamber of Commerce. And you've just rolled off the board chairmanship and passed that off to Darcy, our managing partner. And I know, as a 20-something young kid starting out in Columbus, the vantage point of Columbus business from within the Chamber of Commerce was pretty cool. If you think back, the United Nations came to town. I don't know if you were in town at that point. United Nations came to town. There's a lot of development that doesn't exist anymore. We've built new things over top of it, but it was exciting, vibrant, innovative community then, and it's much more so now. That vantage point from the Chamber, just being involved in the Chamber, but actually being chairman of the board, must have been quite interesting. Last year, an interesting time. What did you see from that vantage point last year that speaks to Columbus, either good or bad, in terms of the business community?
I'll start with this. I'll go back to 2019. And as a result of being the chair, I was invited with Don DePiro, the CEO, to attend the retreat that the Columbus Partnership has annually. They didn't have it last year, and I don't know if they'll have it this year, but it took place at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard, right? Mm-hmm. And Les Wexner was actually, I think, the one that he's got the relationship with that, with the school and that particular college. And they talked about the Columbus Way. And first of all, I'm a small business owner, and all the major CEOs of every organization you can think of in the city, including, I rode down on the private jet with Mike Kaufman from Cardinal Health. We all rode on PJs. And just being in this group and having these preconceived ideas oftentimes about, you know, this guy, you know, putting people on pedestals. That's not meant to be a dig, but what I got a chance to see, Doug, was see them through just, it was almost level. And we had a presentation by a professor, Robert Livingston, and he talked about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we were talking about this in 2019. But the reaction I saw from those heads of companies and their leaning in and sincerity, and I mean true sincerity, really impacted me, man. And the whole Columbus Way piece, really, Don and I left with that on our minds. Coming back into 2020, we were positioned to do some great things. Then the pandemic hit. Chamber had to pivot and go remote, right? We had to go with remote events, and the events for the Chamber, as you know from back when you worked there, that's a big revenue stream for them. But the pivot happened, and the board leaned in. We kind of shortened our board meetings and got very specific and intentional about the things we talked about. We really were looking on how can we make sure we help our members navigate. And I don't know if you were watching some of the communication coming out, but I was so impressed with that pivot and how we became, there was a toolkit, for lack of a better term, that the Chamber was providing on a regular basis, information about pivoting, information about COVID-19, information that was timely and was on point. If you go through the year and then you've got the George Floyd piece that happened around the summertime, the Chamber, we got together as a board, we put out a statement about that. And then behind that, we put a, and I don't know if this is out in the public yet, but we put together a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee and really had them start to first audit us, the Chamber, but more importantly, understand who else is out there playing and how could we fit? And most importantly, what value can we add to our membership? So we're well down the road with that. But I was impressed. This is a vibrant city. Speaking of Darcy, your managing director, so impressed with people like her who, while they're running businesses that are awesome and doing well and generating significant revenue, just this concern about people living in poverty, people living in situations and circumstances that they really didn't have much control over their futures. Just this concern. And then there was the conversations we had. We were on Zoom calls with the partnership, you know, the CIO, the CEO of these organizations, and the sincerity there. So there's a lot of what I saw was this city, the Chamber tested, but the city overall tested. And for me, having, again, some preconceived ideas about these companies and the CEOs and where their interests lie, to see the humanness of those people and what appears and still appears to be sincerity has really, it was thought provoking for me, man. It's been life changing. That whole experience chairing the chamber board has been life changing for me. I learned so much, but I also think that some of those examples I gave you earlier about fetal position and what I learned about, you know, getting up and moving forward, I think there was a lot of value I was able to add for Don, as well as I talked about the Alvis board, Denise, and in my experiences as a small business owner, because the chamber at the end of the day is a small business. Right. It may have a big profile, but it's a small business, 20 plus employees, doesn't have a tremendous like eight figure number at the top of it. So I actually enjoyed watching, and both organizations did very well. And as a result, the service delivery, both organizations, the chamber specifically, the service to our members was spot on. And we've gotten accolades for that. So it feels good to have worked with our board, worked with the leadership, worked with the chamber staff, and come out on the other end.
Is my perspective that some of these types of things, diversity and inclusion, in my world of risk management, it's labor risk. You know, we don't have enough labor. We don't have the right talent. We have people in the market that could be working that for whatever reason, we access knowledge, skills, ability, we can't get them in a seat. So you can get all analytical. At this vantage point, looking backwards, it seems like that we were starting to address some of those things, those labor risks with a human heart in 2019. And then the pandemic hit. And then if you really look at the year, every month was one in a lifetime event. There was, you know, we thought that Kim had died in North Korea. We had the pandemic. We had the George Floyd situation and all the various ripples that came from that, because it wasn't just that event. There were other events associated with it, with the bombing in Nashville. We had the ice storms in Texas. Just one thing after another. You know, it seems like there's an authenticity and a sincerity that's come out for some people. There are some folks that have gotten even harder headed about some of this stuff. But, you know, if you raise people up, the market's bigger. To me, it's a practical thing as well as a human thing to take care of people that would like to get out but don't know how to get out.
Yeah, I agree with you. There seems to be more empathy. And, you know, I'm talking to some leaders around the city, different nonprofits, Columbus Foundation, et cetera. And there's this move and desire to do something. The thing that I caution them all on is let's try not to duplicate effort. Let's leverage and get the most out of the effort, right? Which can be tough to get competing entities to kind of work together. But I think it's a great time for the city. But the thing I'm concerned about now is just the crime, the police shootings here in our city. There's effort. I know that they're trying to figure out how to get these youth, some of the youth that are involved in some of the youth on youth crime, black on black in some cases. How can we give them different inputs to kind of change the trajectory of that? There's the whole piece, as you see politically, with the city and the FOP and the police, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's still food deserts in the city. I mean, there's just a plethora of things. But I feel my sister volunteers for the Middle Ohio food. It's not the pantry anymore. They've got a cooler name now, right? But Collective or something, the Middle Ohio Food Collective.
Yeah, they're a client. We actually work with them and help secure their systems. And they're actually, it's interesting, they're not a food bank. You're right. They do a lot more. They have they're innovating with technology.
Yeah.
And they have an interesting story to tell. And it's, you can apply technology to grow a business and generate profit. And you can apply technology to extend how you take care of people. And that's what I understand they're doing.
Well, and she's been volunteering there forever, but I see a lot more of that where people are lining up to help, where people, irrespective of socioeconomic differences, right? There just seems to be this. And the thing I always say, and I say it out loud, can we sustain this over time? Because I've seen, and you've probably seen situations or circumstances or events in the past, 9/11 might have been one, where people kind of came together and it felt really good. But 6 months, 7 months later, we're kind of leaning and going back to some of the old paradigm, right? So I am feeling pretty good that there's some momentum and there are some goals and objectives that are being set with a willingness to hit and meet those goals and objectives. So I'm doing my part. I'm, you know, if I'm asked to be part of something, if I've got the time, I do it. I share my, you know, my opinion. It's not always necessarily well received, but I don't want to be on the sidelines complaining. I want to be in the game and at least contributing, right? That's just how I'm wired. And my hope is that for Columbus, I can't speak for any other city in because I think Columbus has had resiliency when other parts of the country, other cities have not. My hope is that we can get to the next level. Columbus can get to the next level. I'm not worried about Nashville. I know you talked about the bomb. I don't want them to be bombed, but I think this city's positioned to really take it to the next level. So time will tell, but I think there's a lot of smart people out there and there's some investment happening, both public, private sector. Hopefully the outcome is going to be very positive for us all.
Oh, some of the startups that are out there right now in Columbus, just absolutely cool applications, not just of technology, but financial thinking. A lot of these entrepreneurs are younger. They're not just starting for-profit businesses. They're, you know, we've hearing stories and hoping to share some of those with nonprofit startups that are trying to make a difference in an organized fashion. Yeah, there's a lot of really cool stuff. And again, you know, my vantage point started at the Chamber of Commerce, and you never kind of, once you're a chamber person, you're always a chamber person, whether you're a chairman. And I actually spent part of my time when I had my own business on the Hilliard Chambers board. So I've been at a board level as well. So that board perspective or the staff perspective, you never quite shake. Once you're a chamber person, you're always a chamber person. But it seems like there's a lot more vibrancy today than back in the 90s when I was involved. And Columbus was telling great stories about itself then. And I think some of the stories are even better. And I would agree with you. I think it's got an interesting arc here moving forward into the future in terms of the business and the community's needs and how business can help take care of the community. And it does seem it's why we're telling these stories. It seems like business is stepping up.
Yeah, and I would say the Chamber is really owning their lane. Small, mid-sized businesses. I give Don Tabiro kudos for the team he's put together. And to your point, they've got momentum. They've got significant momentum. And it boggles my mind that with the small staff we have, the impact that we're having, and just all the moving parts, and it's being done, for the most part, flawlessly. The team is leaning in. Yeah, it's a good time for the Chamber right now. It's a good time, and it's a needed time for the Chamber. They just struck a deal with the Urban League. I don't know if you read about that, but the Urban League has identified 30 small Black-owned businesses who, there's a partnership between the Urban League and the Chamber. They're getting membership and getting exposed to some of these, to the networking, some of the technical business pieces, et cetera. So, you know, it's a good time in that. I think that model can be replicated by the Chamber. So
Darcy does not do much on LinkedIn, but I actually read that announcement. You know, she's taken your seat there on the board, and she was pushing that out, very excited about the impact that was going to have.
Yes, and she put it out there, and just on Darcy, she actually helped us evolve in our workforce strategy and the workforce piece we're doing under Kelly Fuller with Darcy's mentorship. It's doing some powerful things, too, much needed things. And it's touching some of those underrepresented communities we talked about. Yep. So they're in those conversations about upskilling, tech, et cetera, as well. The Chamber's playing a pivotal role right now in what potentially can happen for small, mid-sized businesses in Columbus.
That's tremendous to hear. And, you know, looking at it from 2019, we were, as a tech industry, or actually as a business community, short-staffed on tech. And hopefully, like you said, this has some legs and we continue to develop more talent, because at some point the Columbus story is going to change if we don't find a way to get more tech talent here. We can attract people, you know, always attract people, but to have people that are here and capable and not working, sitting on the sidelines, it's a shame, because it's going to raise things for everybody if we can get them engaged. So that's really exciting to hear.
The other impact happening now is companies that aren't domiciled in Ohio are offering tech professionals in Ohio, specifically Columbus, with remote jobs, 100% remote, paying them above market rates. So it's going to get tighter and tighter, Doug.
Yeah, well, I come to PSI to do the recruiting, but I hire tech people, and I know it's difficult. It's just a difficult game. So we're at the end, and at the end, we always ask five questions. And so I'm going to just jump through these questions. We gave them to you in advance, and hopefully you had some time to think about it. It's not gotcha journalism, but let's see what we find out about Keith here. Who inspires you?
So my biggest inspiration has been my mother. And I'll tell you why. My father was a hardworking entrepreneur himself. And I'm the oldest of five kids. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom till my father passed away. And I was 8 years old. My youngest brother was like 1 year old. She'd never really worked. She had to go out and clean houses in Bexley and paid her way through a business school so she could get a job at the DCSE is what it was known for then, the government installation. And I just watched, we were on welfare for a while, Doug. I watched just the work ethic, man, and the grind. And let me say, I didn't really appreciate it until later on getting in business and looking back for it. There's other inspiration I get from, I get inspiration from the usual suspects, but my mother, man, and even still today, just the resilience. And back then, in that time, there wasn't programs out there to help her other than she could get on welfare, but there was no free education. There was no free access to anything. So she's been my biggest inspiration, if I have to be honest with you.
What is your favorite life hack?
Yeah, for me, I like playing chess. Let me just say that this is not to discount people, but for me, and I think everyone should consider this, take some time and look at your network, right? And really understand how broad and wide that network is, both professionally and personally. And how are you managing that network? How are you touching it? You know, there's people that had demonstrable impact on me 20 years ago. One is Iris Cooper, who I still stay in touch with. And that happened as a result of me one day just looking at my network and saying, who should I be in touch with? By doing that, and this was not my intent, but by doing that, I got introduced to a client. So that's on the professional side. On the personal side, and you know this, running a business, oftentimes we're so caught up in running our businesses, when friends and people on a personal note reach out to us, they want us to do something, go to a party, whatever it might be, we don't have time. And pretty soon those calls stop coming. They stop reaching out to you. Yep. And so the life hack for me is leveraging that network and actually putting that network on a big chessboard, if you will, and just understanding where can I touch? How can I move through this group and make sure I'm staying in touch? And I think the last part of that is, I believe networks are so valuable. They just should, and you can tell, you know, you're an accounting firm, it should be an asset on the balance sheet. It's not, but it should have value on the balance sheet.
I'm in an accounting firm. I'm not a CPA, and Darcy Congrove would tell you the last person you want working on your balance sheet off out of our directors would be me. Technology, security, absolutely, but I get what you're saying. Moving on, because I actually think you partially touched on this as you answered that question. You work hard. You obviously don't climb a ladder for 28 years and pivot and do the things you've done without working hard, but how do you balance that? How do you play?
The struggle there is work for me is not really work. It's been gamified in a way, right? And so, but that said, kind of going back to the network piece, it's just taking time out for family, something that I used to do. I've got two sons. I've got two granddaughters, traveling with them, working out, getting in the gym. I play golf and then playing chess, and then reading when I can. So what I've found works for me, so you understand project management, right? I have to schedule that stuff. I can't just have the idea that, you know, I think I'll do that. It has to be on my, that's sad to say, but I have to calendar it in order for me to make sure that I do it.
Last question. What did Keith dream of becoming as a middle schooler?
Yeah. So I talked about my father and his brothers. He had five brothers and they had a band. They used to tour the country. They, this is back when I won't mention the type of music that dates me, but at any rate, they played on the East Coast and they were very good and actually played in some clubs up in Harlem. And in one particular instance that my dad and uncle told me about, mobsters ran the club and would not let them leave because they were bringing in crowds, right? That's just one story. We're from Urbana, Ohio. That's where I was born. So for me, it was being a musician. That's what I had. And I had a couple bands. My brother had bands. I think if my father lived, that probably would have came to fruition for sure. But that was my goal, was just, I wanted to be a musician. So I guess there's a creative side to me, although I do have a keyboard at the house. I haven't touched it in 6 or 7 years, but I walk by it every day. Maybe that's one of those life balances pieces that I need to put on my calendar.
Schedule, right? You schedule that key.
Schedule the keyboard, yeah.
Yeah, next time we talk, I'll ask how much time you scheduled on the keyboard.
Do that, Doug, do that.
So really appreciate your time today. I know that the experiences you've had, the things you've shared have been helpful to people that listen to us. If somebody wants to reach out and connect to you online, what's the best way to get to you?
Yeah, they can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm out there on LinkedIn, and I think my email address is there. You know, once they connect with me, we can connect then through cell, call, whatever. But yeah, I'm available.
All right.
Now, I've got a lot of people now have asked me to be their mentor, and I can't commit to any kind of regular cadence, but I can definitely have a conversation and share. Yeah,
you can't mentor everyone.
Yeah. And I don't know that I'm built to mentor everyone either. That's the other piece as well, right? I may not be the right person.
Well, I think chemistry. For sure. I've had, you know, mentors in my life, but I think chemistry, no. Your chemistry is wonderful. You can probably mentor a lot of people, but it, you know, chemistry and that connection is an important part about that. We don't all match up with everybody. So I hear you there.
But I love doing it, Doug. I believe in giving to get to give, right? So you got to give it away, whether it's to someone you're mentoring, doing nonprofit work, doing community work, you know, raising up your staff, you know, empowering them. That for me is the beauty of it, because when you give that out, it comes back almost like a professor or a teacher. I want to be remembered as their favorite teacher, right? I remember some of my favorite teachers and why. And so that's always kind of top of mind for me.
Well, I'll close with this. I know that you uplift your staff, because when I spend time with them, they talk about it. And in fact, Monty in particular talked about how much you taught him. So it's actually happening. You may be more of that than you know.
Well, it's two way. Thank you. I've learned from Monty as well. But thank you, Doug. I appreciate what you're doing. I think it's adding value, and kudos to you, because you don't have to do it, right?
Thank you. Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?